Well, hello there and good evening. It's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Great to see you on the 9th of June, 2020. Thanks very much for spending some time with us. I have Tony Lacantro from Perth ready to join me in a second. And we're going to have some fun tonight, hopefully. So let me just push that button there. And then if I do that, Tony, hello there.
Evening, Martin, and evening, viewers. I really appreciate this opportunity to be live. I've finally got my act together with audio. I'm now wearing Apple AirPods. So my 16-year-old son came over and helped me. So I'm looking forward to it, Martin, and a lot of questions, a bit of fun. And as a disclaimer, when I made comments about consumerism, everyone ripped into me and said I've got two flat-screen TVs in the background. One is actually a computer monitor, and the other one is a $600 Hisense TV. So I'm not around.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
I think Lacantro's a drama queen while I'm... So anyway.
Yeah, that's good. You're actually just a little bit choppy at the moment, but the signal from Perth comes and goes, as always does, but no problem. And great to have you on there, Tony. So you've now got live out, and hopefully everybody can hear Tony. Give me a thumbs up and make sure that everybody can, hear what's going on. Just in terms of, by way of introduction, let me just highlight that this isn't financial advice. It's very important people understand that this is not financial advice. This is just a general chat. Please don't take it as such. You do need to get specific advice if you're going to make plans around financial things. Secondly, please play nice in the chat room. As normal, we are actually moderating this, and if there's stuff going on, we'll get rid of it. This is at the 9th of June, of course. If you're watching this in replay, use that Walk the World to get my attention. If you want to ask a question for Tony, there's always tons of stuff going on the chat. We don't have time necessarily to look at all of the stuff that's going on the chat, but if you use that, Walk the World. Finally, Super Chat's enabled, and that will be a way to be able to, one, make a contribution to helping us, and two, getting your question noticed. So that's it. And you may notice we've got a bit of tech now working quite well with our charts and things. So hopefully that's all working well. Okay, great. Now, Tony, I think a good place to start this conversation is just a little bit of background on you. Now, you know, you've said in your previous post that you're a police officer, worked in the East Coast, went across to Perth. How did you get into the investment management space? What drove you in that direction?
Oh, great question, Martin. I always try to pick changing trends. I could get in the police car and say to my partner, we're going to have a quiet night tonight. So the beauty about being a cop was I was working 12-hour shifts. So obviously when I was young and a lot more attractive, I used to enjoy going to parties and noise complaints, and I could actually take most of the week off. And then I was stationed just across the road from the stock exchange, and I used to walk over there in full uniform and talk to speculators, and I learnt the market. Then I came over to Perth and interviewed 20 mining companies, turned that into a book, and then started in the stock market on the small cap stocks. I had a great career in the police. I was actually stationed at Redfern in 1994 when I was dodging bricks and bottles pretty much every shift. And I think that subject matter is topical now with the BLM protests and the madness of the world. And I was actually looking back at my policing days, and on my YouTube page, there's a video of me interviewed over some dead pigeons, Martin. So pigeon lives matter.
Very good, Tony, very good.
All lives matter, but the pigeon lives...
Yeah, absolutely.
I've got myself at the top, but
there you go. Very good.
So now I'm doing what I'm doing.
Mm. Yeah, great. Well, there's a bunch of comments. Let's just... go straight in there, and I hope you like my new flash little social media widget here. Edwin says, signal comes and goes, so do government grants, Tony and Martin. Now, what about this Western Australian property grant thing, which was announced over the weekend, right? another chunk of money being thrown at the property sector. No surprise, maybe. What did you think about it, Tony?
Interesting perspective from our government. We had Mark McGowan, of course. We had Matthias, everyone's indulgent Cormann, who I actually agree with. So the way I look at it is we've still got, as opposed to the East Coast, we've still got these corridors north and south of the freeway. We've got areas such as Alkimos, which under Keystar were becoming mortgage prisons anyway. So I don't know if it's really going to stimulate things at all. I mean, we've had 6 years in Perth of being sandpapered to death property-wise. So I don't think this is going to stimulate anything. A lot of land sales in the eastern areas are similar to, I don't know, St Mary's, Mount Druitt, those type of areas, I don't think are going to boom either. So I think it's good to try and stimulate the trade activity, but we're still on the way down in Perth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. It will be interesting to see whether it has any effect. Of course, the package is available for property investors, overseas investors and interstate investors, I noticed, as well as local ones. So they are quite desperate.
Yeah, it's. But I guess they've got to do what they've got to do. And this stimulus at the moment, I say everyone's got the tired sillies. It's just a weird period in history where everyone's had a massive sugar fix, or they've gouged on KFC and they've been offered some more.
Yeah, indeed. And one of the comments that came up was from Cookie Boy. Basically, what are Tony's thoughts on the property handout? So there you go, Cookie. And the reason I've done that is I just wanted to do this and highlight this from... So Cookie Boy basically said, if you get more than 1,000, he's going to make another contribution to charity. $5 for each time this is retweeted, and I think you've got pretty much 50 retweets. And $5 for each time Big T swears. Now, hopefully Big T won't swear too much.
No.
But anyway, I thought that was quite... and Cookie, thanks very much for your support. It is hugely appreciated. So there you go. Okay, now let me just go back to there so that people can see you both. I forgot to switch you in, so I heard your voice but didn't see your face, Tony. My apologies for that. Okay, and while we're talking, Dean actually commented on my conversation with George Gammon, which I recorded today and is now up. George made the point, Tony, that the markets are nuts. They've disconnected completely from reality in terms of, you know, the market values. And, you know, the US market hit highs. They're back to sort of where they were previously. The Australian market's high too. What's your perspective on what's going on with the markets? And, you know, are they really disconnected from reality or what's going on?
The markets, the way I see it, is they've priced in a V-shaped recovery already. So what's happened is we've got a lot of bad news, but the bad news has become so obvious that markets have had a relief rally on bad news that was expected. So I'm of the opinion now that once good news, well, can't really be good news, once we start to come out of the COVID, businesses get back to normal or somewhat, I think the stock markets are going to endure a long correction, Martin. And, you know, when you see stocks like Westpac touch over $20 today, it's hideously overvalued. The earnings growth in the S&P in the States isn't going to be there. We're not going to have the same level of earnings here. And we still have a property bloodbath to come in Australia. So I think this stock market is an amazing sell, Martin.
an amazing sell. And that's actually exactly what George said as well. So he bought at the bottom, very selectively. But he's saying, look, it's interesting, the smart investors like Warren Buffett, and they're all sitting on the sideline with lots of cash, right? None of them are actually piling in. And George's comment was, it's a lot of the, you know, the small investors, the speculative investors, the ones who actually are basically trading on a, you know, a hope of ever higher prices that are actually the ones being taken to the cleaners. So it'll be very interesting to see how that that plays out.
Yeah, there's actually a comment today I read on Robin Hood where someone asked, if they bought a stock and it went down, could they hand it back? So there you go. That's the type of questions you're getting. And It's amazing. And I think CommSec hasn't seen this level of interest in a long time. We've got ladies on the news that have fluked Afterpay. It's, as I said, I predicted this even before COVID, that the market would transform into an even bigger casino and people are going to lose money. Anyone day trading, they get lucky. I just think a whole new generation of investors are going to get absolutely torched. But as a broker, relying on volume, it's the best thing that could have happened. I've never been busier, Martin.
Well, that's good. Good for the brokers, good for the finance industry. Of course, a lot of the investment banks are now reporting significantly enhanced trading volumes and also trading fees as well. So, you know, there are winners and losers. I just worry that the losers don't realise they're losers yet. they'll be caught short later.
Yeah. I mean, that's the market. There's publicly available information, but earnings have decoupled from reality. The US markets have factored in something which isn't going to occur, and that means a bear market. But viewers should realise that the bear market rallies are the most powerful because they suck people in, and then people get another case of FOMO. Then suddenly there's no speculative fervour at all. And I think the same's going to happen to the property market as well.
Yeah, interesting. So Hamish made a really interesting comment that there's nowhere to put your money right now. To what extent do you think that's true?
I'm going to go and disagree. I think, look, I talked to a lot of your viewers that have, I told one today that he had far too much money. So this is someone that's got around $2 million in cash, and all they do is worry about it. They don't know, they've got to spread it amongst eight banks. They've got lots of physical gold and silver, but the physical gold and silver play, Martin, has suffered because we've had a synchronized shit economy across the world. The whole world's turned to it. Prior to COVID, the Australian dollar was heading towards 52, 53. Now, based on the whole world is in a spot of bother, the Australian dollar has seen it and touched above 70 cents. So the gold and silver performance in Australian dollars is getting tired. Banks, you have to be careful. The blue chip stocks in Australia are massively overpriced. They're massively overpriced on a global basis. I think that you have to become a stock picker. So finally, the stock picker will come to the fore. But you have to pick small companies that become bigger ones. And the stock market is, the share ownership in Australia is the safest in the world. But if you're looking for growth companies, just look outside the financials and just be careful of chasing yield. So I can understand your viewers having that opinion, and I've spoken to them. A lot of them are downtrodden because they think, well, why isn't my gold in Aussie dollars soaring? Because it's now struggling around 2019 last I looked. Silver, gold and silver has done its job, Martin. It maintains purchasing power. But to make money, you have to go aggressive, and that's outside day trading, outside traditional property. Maybe some areas, you might see some regional property bubbles, but who's going to pick them? Mm. Maybe you've got some insights, Martin, into what areas. I know people in the orange area are seeing land values soar. And anyone wanting to buy agricultural land, prices are actually soaring. It's a supply-demand issue. And the realisation that you don't have to live in a city now to work with what we've seen through COVID. So if you can pick a regional hotspot, well done. Obviously, my scenario is I want a beach, I want a cafe, and I want a Meyer. But good luck finding that.
Good. And Steve said, central banks around the world are still printing. Surely we'll continue to see asset price, property shares rise. Is that where inflation is being hidden, and how long can it go on for? That's a very interesting and complicated question. If you've got a take on it, I'll be interested, and then I'll perhaps give you my perspective too.
I think people need to know the difference between money printing and quantitative easing. QE is where they go in and buy assets and bonds, and you do have buying of distressed assets and a lot of the junk assets. So I think a lot of the stock market valuations, what you're seeing is basically institutional FOMO, Martin, and the Fed can step in. But once you start to see some negativity, and last I looked, finally, the Dow Jones futures were down over 200 points, which is, it's a relief. I'm sick of seeing the market rise this much. So I don't think any amount of stimulus is going to work once we get over the tide sillies, which I think the world is in now. And the BLM rallies have put COVID on the back, on the second page of the news, which I just can't believe at all. So we just had a distraction from a distraction. And the other point I want to make is I expected the social unrest. I expected people to go into Rodeo Drive and help themselves to handbags, but not from the death of George Floyd.
Yeah, it's again interesting talking to George Gammon about his perspective on how this has flushed out a whole wave of social unrest and a whole bunch of issues that people are essentially not, you know, it's not just the, you know, killing black people, but it's actually broader than that as well in terms of a degree of social unrest that's, you know, partly driven by COVID, but partly driven by the inequality that's just being reinforced. My perspective on this is that, I think I've said this before, there are two alternative futures. There is a future where inflation starts raging, and that's because the banks keep printing, and as they keep printing, essentially that's going to inflate asset prices. But asset prices don't necessarily translate into real prices, you know, in the real economy. And so if wages continue to get compressed and if unemployment stays high, we could look at an alternative where it's effectively a deflationary environment like Japan. And I don't think we know which of those two scenarios is going to be. We know that the money supply is going much higher than it was previously, and yet we're not seeing any inflation. And so the really interesting question is, are we measuring the right things relating to inflation? You know, is inflation a lot higher than actually the official numbers? Probably. But is it actually also a risk that we could get a deflationary spiral, in which case ultimately that's going to push more and more pressure onto people with debt? And if those people then start falling over, that's enough to then start degrading the asset prices that have been pumped up by the central bank's printings. So it's very unclear to me as to which of these two futures we're going to get to. And I guess, Tony, the point is that if you think the future is going to be highly inflationary, then you know, you'll position one way. If you think it's going to be deflationary, you're probably going to position somehow different.
I think we definitely have a period of stagflation to get through before we can have some deeper thought. For viewers not aware what stagflation is, it's the economic equivalent of being sandpapered to death. It's basically an inflationary recession where you have costs increase and the economy is going backwards. I think that's definitely where we are now. And the last period, real period, was in the 70s, and it was probably one of the ugliest periods in financial history. So I don't think there's any decent scenarios to come out of this, Martin. And I hope to hell we don't end up like Japan. I'd rather just see a stock standard, off-the-shelf, Irish-style property correction and subsequent recovery. So, I hope to hell we don't turn Japanese, because that's going to be a life of hell, unfortunately.
Yes, unfortunately. But you see, the Japanese have been at it the longest, right? And they've, you know, the Central Bank of Japan owns about 40% of the Japanese economy, all right? And the Bank of Japan has about half of the US dollar swap lines from the Fed. So they are absolutely caught in the middle. It's very interesting. And I hope, but, you know, not quite sure exactly. somebody said here, the markets are nuts and all the squirrels are buying. it's probably about right. Okay. Now, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, Tony, and it's actually come up in a few of the posts, is you've on a few occasions, you know, talked about the social disruption and the social stress that's being created by the financial pressures that are on households. And, you know, I just want to get your latest thoughts on that, because it seems to me that as some of the issues relating to the support mechanisms that the government are now rolling back, you know, the childcare thing, my feeling is that we haven't yet seen the peak of the pressure on households, and therefore we haven't seen the pressure build to its max yet in terms of the social impacts of that. But what do you think?
I totally agree. I think if you have a look at how the subsidies were spent, a lot of it was on gambling and clothes. I think a lot of the smarter people out there would have squirreled the money away. To me, this period is like, it's like getting a payday loan, I think, for many families, sadly, Martin. And I just think that with the childcare wound back, with these JobKeeper payments to cease in September, I just think it's been a short-term life support, and I think families would be under immense pressure now based on the lack of job security. We're still seeing more job cuts now. The ABC's calling for redundancies. The online media, journalist job gone. Yeah, I just think we're going to be in a world of pain. And you have to say, well, the government's done its best to prop everyone up. But the reality is, if you wind back to the pre-COVID economy, it wasn't pretty. I don't know what people are thinking that we're going, when we come out of this, what we're going to head back to. So I'd say that personal balance sheets are going to worsen. We've seen huge increases in calls to Lifeline. We've had suicides. We've had a massive increase in domestic violence. You're now seeing new advertising campaigns based on domestic violence. I don't know how bad the rallies are going to get in Australia, BLM-wise. We saw what can happen in the US, which is absolute madness. So I don't think we've seen the COVID social unrest yet. And I think people housebound by COVID just wanted to get the hell out of the house. And why not go and cause a heap of property damage and throw stuff at police for something they probably don't even know, realise what they're protesting. So, you know, this is the... In 2017, the world went crazy on crypto, property and other bubbles. In 2020, it's just gone nuts. Absolute madness in the world, Martin. And I think, well, what can you say? If you're fearing for your job, you're not going to go out and build a new house. You're not going to spend $150,000 on renovations when that money will be evaporated once the property market gets to where it should be.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have this view, and of course I see it through my surveys, that many households are definitely being crunched at the moment. And the truth is that we won't know for a few months how this all plays out, because we don't know how many jobs are going to disappear completely. We do know that a lot of households are now in multiple part-time jobs. And, the fact of the matter is that they can't necessarily get sufficient income to come in to cover all the costs even now. And as the government's support dissipates one way or the other, that's going to come to the fore. But I think if you think about superannuation, that's under pressure. And by the way, I might just, as we're talking about superannuation, the latest data came out today from APRA, and the total amount now taken out of superannuation funds under the COVID relief scheme, $13.5 billion, the average $7,473, and 1.81 million of applications paid. That's a big deal, in my view. And, part of the issue there is we know that quite a few people who are pulling money out of superannuation are not directly impacted by COVID. Right. So from my surveys, Tony, quite a few of them are using it as an opportunity to accumulate a deposit to buy a property. And then they're going to go and use the state grants as well. And basically they'll be able to construct a deposit and then go buy a property in a few months' time. So there's a lot of complexity in what's going on. And I don't think we're going to see all this coming out until 6 months, 12 months. But I also don't think we're going to see a V-shaped recovery. I just don't see how that's going to flow from what I'm seeing in terms of all the data that's coming through my my models at the moment.
That can't happen. And you're right about the superannuation, because a lot of those funds taken out are being misused. I guess people have to survive. And I guess Scott Morrison said people can spend it any way they want. But the point is, if you're going to use that to go and buy an asset that's going to depreciate or a car that's going to depreciate, it's not good, and people don't realise how much, in fact, they're going to cost themselves once it comes time to retire. That's a huge chunk, and I'm sure people could find a way to survive without that relief because they're going to go through it quickly, and there are other ways to sandbag your finances.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've always said on your show that people need to sell stuff they don't need. I see that advice coming now. But, you know, the market is going to be flooded with laser printers. They'll actually end up on the curbside, sadly. Everyone's gone out and bought printers, all this home office equipment. That's going to be on the curbside. Treadmills, you've got to sandbag your finances before everyone else does. And I hope your viewers have done that, Martin.
Yeah, I think it's good advice, Tony. Unfortunately, many people are still not really quite waking up to the reality of what's going on. And I think they are still clinging to it's a V-shape, you know. And, of course, the politicians are also saying it's a V-shape. And, you know, but if you look at what the Reserve Bank said, they said unemployment will be at 7% in the next year, right? And the World Bank came out with a pretty gloomy forecast for global growth, which is, you know, very negative. The IMF came out previously. And, you know, all of the leading indicators are suggesting that we've got a lot of pain ahead. So, yeah, for me, it's a big deal. And I think people should prepare accordingly rather than just rushing out and buying that property that perhaps will fall in value in the next couple of years. Now, I've got just a few few comments here. Mud and Mooks says, great show. Thank you, Ray. Appreciate that.
Yeah.
We like to have those sorts of comments. Neil basically asked your thoughts of a currency war on a weak US dollar when we're nowhere to go but negative rates. So negative rates, US dollar. What's your thoughts on that, Tony? I might come in after that as well with my thoughts on negative rates.
Oh, well, we're certainly heading towards it, aren't we? But a weak US dollar, it could come under attack. I mean, who would have thought our dollar would be just under 70, Martin? But, you know, Trump's a lot of talk. Their economy, you know, we've got some political unrest coming in as well. And who knows what's going to happen? Are we going to have an Australia bubble or a New Zealand bubble? You know, you've seen these bubbles occur, like Japan, you know, Sweden, Denmark, those countries as well. So it's an interesting question, but at the moment I don't know, and I'd certainly be interested to hear your opinion, Martin, on that one.
Yeah, well, I've had the view for some time that the Reserve Bank will try and resist negative rates, but of course the effective cash rate, although it's officially at 0.25%. If you look at the rate between central bank and the banks, it's a zero or 0.12 or wherever it is. It's very, very low at the moment. And there isn't a lot of likelihood that it's going to go any higher. So basically, there is no charge for borrowing or placing money at the Reserve Bank. So they may well be forced to effectively impose essentially a cost on the banks if they give money to the RBA, right? So that's where I think negative rates could start to emerge. And that's what we saw in Europe and indeed in Japan. That's where it started. So it was effectively at a central bank level. But over time, that then starts flowing through to the broader economy. And if you look at Germany, there are more than 100 banks now in Germany with negative interest rates on deposits. And so that's the problem. It starts then spilling over into other parts of the economy. And if you end up in the situation where effectively deposits are actually costing people, then they don't tend to put the money in the system. If they can get it out, talk about the cash man, or they do other things. They take higher risk alternatives to try and actually get a return. So there is a risk. Now, I know the Federal Reserve has basically said, no, we're not going to do negative rates, and Canada said the same. But just remember this. The guy in charge of the Bank of England 3 or 4 weeks ago said, no, we'll never do negative rates. And then the following week came out and said, we probably will do negative rates. So nothing is certain. And it's all to do with this weird situation that we're in, where all this money printing, all this asset creation is going into the financial system, but it's not going to the real economy. And because of that, some of the assumptions we normally make about the way economies work may not actually be very accurate. So my view is, I wouldn't be surprised to see negative rates here in Australia, but probably not for a little while. When they come, it'll be a huge, huge shock. And that could definitely put the cat among the pigeons in terms of asset prices, property prices, and a whole bunch of other things, because it signals the really deep issues we have in our economy. And remember, you know, Japan has been at this for 20 odd years and has still not been able to solve the problem. The Fed has been talking about the fact they're going to be buying bonds for the next 5 years or more. We are in a cul-de-sac. I keep saying we've got ourselves into this cul-de-sac, and I'm not sure there's a way out. So, you know, perhaps we should try tunneling or something. But no, that's my perspective.
Yeah.
Now, let's have a look. Somebody asked, oops, no, that's not working. Okay. Interesting. I'm trying a new app here to post to YouTube the tweets and or the chats, and it's just frozen again. So for some reason, this is not quite as robust as I hoped it would be, but never mind. We'll carry on. So there was a question that Nefi asked, have I done any videos on Australian stagflation? I have actually discussed this a couple of times. If you look at my first conversation with George Gowan from about 2 months ago, we actually debated inflation, deflation. So that's one there. And in fact, John Adams and I are preparing a show at the moment to specifically explore this, because we think this is a really important conversation. And, you know, the fact is that I'm not sure we know which way it's going to go, but what I'm interested in is trying to work out what the leading indicators would be to know which way it was likely to go, because that seems to me to be the most critical question, insofar that if we do know, you know, what those leading indicators are, then we can begin to prepare. So I don't know. It's complicated, difficult. I'm not sure anybody truly knows. Vanessa said she doesn't think that rates are going to work in the US. I think that's probably right, Vanessa. Remember that, of course, the central bank in the US is owned by the banks. And the banks, of course, have degraded profits in a negative interest rate environment. So the central bank in the US is absolutely going to resist negative rates for as absolutely as long as possible. So I think that's something else just to bear in mind. Now, here's an interesting one. Let's go there. Now, according to Koshy, times have never been better. One of his points for the rationale is interest rates are really, really low. Now, that's an interesting conversation. So this is a conversation, I think, Tony, about trajectory of home prices, right? And I can mount the argument two ways. So the Reserve Bank says, never mind about the level of credit because that's not important. The only thing that's important is low interest rates. The lower the interest rates go, the higher home prices go, right? That's essentially their argument, and that's what Koshy is actually saying, pretty much the same. And, of course, Mr. Joy, for example, argues that that's precisely why we're going to get higher home prices ahead, because the affordability is actually better than it's ever been, despite the fact, of course, that the mortgage is a lot bigger. So therefore, you're having to put more of your money in to get it. On the other hand, my argument is debt is too high, debt is unserviceable, and as a result of that, prices are going to fall, not rise. Where do you sit, and do you still hold your bet with you know who?
Well, the issue is now that CoreLogic have stopped the index. How do we price it? And at the moment, there's a lack of volume coming through. I've read where prices are indeed falling, but I don't think serviceability and low interest rate, Martin, is an issue. It's quite simply the end of a speculative bubble where you have an exhaustion of buyers. Credit is obviously going to be harder to get. The banks are going to tighten up. And once the fear of not making capital gains emerges, then it's going to be like trying to suck an ocean through a straw. So I can just see that you're going to see a lot of sales start to a lot of people are going to try and get out, hopefully prior to September. And I did speak to quite a leading real estate agent in Melbourne who was saying that, yeah, his limited stock is selling, but the problem will be once volumes increase is to find buyers at those stupid prices. So I liken this correction. It's a bad analogy. You know how James Bond gets captured and the villain works out complicated ways to kill James Bond? Just bloody shoot James Bond. Don't have this fire that builds, or throw him in a shark tank with... Just get the bloody thing over and done with. I think Australians are presented with this beautiful window to get the hell out. And I just can't believe it. It just keeps on going. They're throwing money at it. You're having... Koshy's saying times have never been better. Well, he's on Sunrise. And he has to say that, Martin. He can't come out and say, well, house prices are going to get poleaxed, families are under stress, domestic violence, kids being yanked out of private schools, Audis replaced with Toyota Corollas. That's the reality. And we're talking about what's actually happening while you've got the mainstream press are saying that everything's rosy. Well, it's not. And I don't think that because we haven't seen the correct figures come out, it doesn't mean it's not going to happen. And every property bubble in history has burst. And as Morgan Kelly's probably one of the best researchers of housing bubbles. If you look at his research on Ireland, you lose 70% of your gains. So this, the four most expensive words in history are, this time is different. And as opposed to the three most expensive words in history, which are, I love you. So it's just a matter of time. It's just a matter of time. And Cookie Boy put up a property out near Ropes Crossing where it sold for 25% less than other houses in the suburb. And a real estate agent only needs two or three of those, and suddenly you've got price discovery. So I'm not making any changes to the property market. As I said, we've got the tired sillies. We've gouged on these handouts. A lot of people haven't got them, but you know, in Perth, we've had 6 years of pain and it's still going on. So I think the property issue is going to be the next issue once we deal with what the world's dealing with, which is COVID, opening up borders, getting people back to work and dealing with these ridiculous protests as well.
Yeah, I agree. Here's an interesting one from Richie Rich saying, Chris Joy has clearly never left his Sydney bubble and been to Perth or any other place where property prices don't follow his edict. And I think that's a very good observation because, you know, I've been watching the Perth market for some time, as you have, Tony, of course. And the behaviour of the Perth market is actually an object lesson. Remember that the economic environment in the West, you know, maybe a little bit different to the East, but the bank rate settings, you know, the cash rate wasn't different. It was unemployment that was different, right? And then it was the mining boom coming away and then effectively the migration that started. So you've got a reduction in population. You've got a lot of building that was done early on. You've got now a lot of property price falls. And I've always quote Mandurah, right, as my archetypal postcode, because there I could see mortgage stress building 3 or 4 years ago, and now we've got 20% property price falls, and we've got high levels of property distress there, negative equity. And I keep saying we need to learn from the West and understand that that could be our future. And yet, you know, a lot of the people who are making decisions and want to make decisions are all in that bubble down the East Coast. Truth is, I think there's a lot we can learn from the West.
Agree. And viewers should realise that Fortescue was a 9-cent stock and just came off a record high of $145. It's just come off a record high, for Christ's sake. Our gold producers are spitting cash. So you've still got the high vis. They're still working. The mines haven't shut down. And we've still got 6 years. You know, we're coming up to 7 years of decline. What one thing I have noticed, though, Martin, is I'm going to have another change in living circumstances. So I've started to look around to rent a bigger house, and the rental market here is that tight, and it's starting to remind me of 2006 where I had to get my ex-wife and my kids into a place where I had to pay 6 months in advance and bid over the other person. So I don't know. We just haven't seen that flow through from Airbnb, but the Perth vacancy rate is falling and it's certainly getting tough within a 10K radius. But I don't think that's going to lead to higher prices. But, I mean, that's just in probably contrast to what we're seeing on the East Coast.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And, you know, like I say, I regard the West Coast as a bit of a leading indicator of what could happen here. Now, there are some differences, but there are some similarities. And mortgage stress levels are going up 37.5% at the moment. A signal, I think, of more trouble ahead potentially. So, yeah, this is a big deal. Definitely a big deal. Now, one of the questions that came through earlier on, I sent this one to you beforehand, was this. Would it have been better to direct new housing and renovation grants into building, re-equipping and retooling manufacturing industries that can create new products and new jobs that would retain many tradies' jobs and set Australia up for a post-COVID export push into diversified markets? Sounds like too much sense to me. Tony, what do you think?
It does make too much sense. Definitely, we certainly need to go hard at infrastructure, look at new work. I mean, we've just had, you know, Holden are going through their final clearance sale. I mean, we've killed our motor industry. A lot of other jobs are going offshore. We've just become uncompetitive. A lot of the fashion labels are going under, retail's going under. I mean, I just think it's probably too early to look at that, to be honest, once we assess the damage. But that home builder scheme has been widely slammed, and so it should. And I just read that 12,000 people have applied for it as well. So I think to transform Australia, we're going to have to actually go through this crisis first, Martin.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, Tony. But I don't know whether you saw, there was a very interesting, well, I thought it was interesting. I did a show with a senator from Queensland, backbencher senator from the Liberal side of government. And he's very frustrated that the government is thinking so narrowly about trying to help the economy and focus on housing. And, you know, because his argument was we actually do need to have a different way of thinking. We do need to try and find a way to invest in manufacturing. We do need to have, you know, a bank that actually wants to support the development of new businesses. And I think he was quite brave to say this, and it's actually, you can go watch the show, you know. But the other interesting thing is that I had somebody approach me the other day from a very innovative electronics company who's based in Australia. I won't say who it is, but they're saying, you know, what you've got going on this channel in terms of having a conversation about an alternative strategy of the future that isn't just based housing based is so critical, and yet, you know, nobody really wants to have that conversation. So they want to actually engage with me and perhaps make some joint shows and things to try and actually spread the word more strongly that there is an alternative strategy that could be created that could potentially create much more value, real value long term, rather than just building the the next house. Remember, we got a million spare properties across Australia, a million already, right? And we're building another 250,000. So it's not like we don't, you know, there's a shortage. It's just pretty amazing. Yeah, okay. Now, let's have a look. What else have we got here? Cookie Boys makes an interesting point. We need a hedonic index for everything, and the economy will always be booming. So that good old hedonic index, which has disappeared, right? Actually, you can still find it evidence. For example, if you go to the ASX, it actually is reported still, and they do actually report it on a monthly basis. It's not completely dead, but the daily reports, of course, have pretty much gone at the moment. Though interestingly, I did see that the REA is talking about some alternative metrics, so I'm exploring that at the moment to see what that could look like. But I think Cookie's onto a winner there, insofar that we probably do need to have a different way of thinking about it. So thanks for that. Now let's see what else we've got. Yeah, that's one, another one from Vanessa. She says, my property is full, my inbox is full of property junk. I get the same. And I don't know whether you've noticed, but on the DFA shows, there are suddenly a lot of adverts, spruiking, rent vesting and all sorts of things. So suddenly, you know, I mean, everywhere you look, people are talking about, and, you know, there's no facts and figures. It's just sort of, you know, verbiage, frankly. I just find it amazing that there's all this stuff going out there. And people, of course, are still reacting to it. They're still actually, frankly, being somewhat, I think, misled by the true state of play. But, of course, a lot of people are quite happy about that and just want to keep the dream going a bit longer. And that's really the problem. And, of course, the government, you know, through its handouts, both state and federally, is just trying to keep the bubble going too. Question is it really sensible where we are? Is it really the right thing to do? Or should we be focusing more on this idea of manufacturing and investing in real things? Personally, I think we should, but there you go. I've certainly found that, you know, an alternative there that I think is worth exploring, but many people just don't want to buy it. Now, Tony, one question I've got for you. Airbnb. I don't know what the story is in Perth, but over here in the East, there are a lot of property investors who basically were paying for their properties through Airbnb rentals because they were getting much higher returns. And of course, that's pretty much folded at the moment because of what's going on. There might be a few coming back now, if you can move around the state or, you know, whatever. But is there a similar thing going on down the West Coast? You know, is there a lot of Airbnb stuff, or what's the story? Do you know?
I haven't seen the deluge yet of properties. I guess there's a lot of interstate travel here, but from reading, going through real estate comp, I just haven't noticed it within the greater Perth metropolitan area yet. And as you know, a lot of savvy investors went out and signed multiple leases and then used the income of the seven places they had, and suddenly that gains up. So I just think that's an issue that's still waiting to happen. So I think people are still going to be cautious. Mm. And again, but no, I haven't seen that just yet, Martin.
No, interesting. Well, my surveys are saying that property investors, about 12% are looking to sell, up from 8% last month. Half of that movement was Airbnbs, because basically they're saying, well, I can't make it work if I don't get the Airbnb return. So I think we've got a long way to go yet. Here's another one from Cookie Boy. The world iron ore is now over $100. Will it continue to rise or will it crash? Now, that's a really interesting one. Of course, the reason it's gone up is because Vale, you know, the big Brazilian mining sector, has been hit by COVID. So they've basically eased back on their production. In the meantime, China has been taking quite a lot of materials, and so the price has gone up. Now, the question is, one, how long will Brazil be out of action and will that actually come back on stream? Two, will China keep taking our iron ore? And I guess there's a broader question there about the relationship between Australia and China. And as you saw at the weekend, you know, China's basically said, we don't want to recommend people come to Australia because of the racism and things like that. I think this is part of a bigger thing going on. So it's hard to know, I think, on the iron ore. But, of course, it's benefiting at one level. But remember that the exchange rate to the Aussie dollars now moved up from 55 to 70. So, effectively, all of that movement in the iron ore price is actually offset by the exchange rate movement. So, net-net, I wouldn't be surprised to see our export values dropping rather than rising. But I don't know. Any thoughts, Tony?
I think when you've got a disruption due to COVID in Brazil, I think the price is right for a correction. And as I mentioned earlier, Martin, Fortescue has just come off its all-time high price. So I actually put a sell on Fortescue. I just don't think that sector's worth being near at the moment. And I still think that, you know, companies can still operate even with a lower price environment. But it wasn't that long ago, Martin, where staff at Fortescue had to take their own cutlery to work. And that's how bad the iron ore sector got. And if you go back to Lindsay David's book, Australia Boom to Bust, he was probably the most accurate forecaster of the iron ore price when it actually plumbed those depths. So I think it's a sector that could turn badly pretty quick as well. So I wouldn't be near that sector. Sure, it might have some more legs, but you're right. The real benefit has been offset by our Aussie dollar.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, here's one from Greg. Greg, what's the midterm outlook for small cap WA gold miners, Tony? Now, that'll be up your alley.
Yeah, I had a look through the gold producers today. To be honest, Martin, I think the sector's overvalued, to be honest. I look at some of the market caps. You've got companies like De Grey who are building a sizable resource, but their market cap's $714 million. Even the smaller producers, you're paying $200 million for them. So in my opinion, we've had our time with the gold producers. It's been a stellar period from 2014 up until now. But I'm thinking the whole sector is tired. The Aussie dollar gold price is now back under 2,500. I don't see any value in the gold producers. I'm sticking now to small cap gold companies that I feel will grow, but that will require a gold downturn. And that's how Bill Beament from Northern Star built his company, by buying assets in a downturn. And I was part of that early capital raising with Bill, which we completed at 5 cents per share. And I think Northern Star recently peaked at $15 a share, but we required a downturn. So I'm certainly worth having a look at the production quarterlies for the June quarter. So these reports should trickle through in the next few weeks. But I think a lot of that gold sector is overpriced and ripe for a correction. And we've been taking profits. So I'm looking further down the food chain, Martin. Sadly, two little gold companies I was heavily involved in have just had opportunistic takeovers. So, I mean, Alt Resources and Alto Metals. So the Chinese have come in and they've realised that it's cheaper to buy ounces than go through the discovery phase where it could take 10 years to mine it. So I'm not entirely bullish on the major gold stocks at the moment.
Okay, interesting. And there's a few other people in the chat who also think that potentially there might be OTC at the moment. George said, let's put him up, gold producers peaked 3 weeks ago, so that'll be an interesting one, a few other people too. So, I think it's quite interesting, and who knows? I mean, you know, there are so many variables out there at the moment. Now, let's just see what else I've got. Just want to acknowledge Matt there. Matt, thank you very much for that. Really appreciate it. And you're helping us to just keep the show on the road. I will actually go through the super chats towards the end of the show, make sure we haven't missed anybody. But I just want to acknowledge that one. Thanks very much, Matt. I appreciate it. Really does make a big difference to us being able to do what we do here. I'll just go down the list and see what else we have, Tony. So what about the biotech sector? So there's a few people asking about biotech and, of course, linking it perhaps to COVID. And I know you've been quite keen on some of those in the sector. Or are they now overpriced? What's your thinking?
I think, look, as with any bubble, you're going to have a lot of crap. You're going to have a lot of quality companies. In fact, one of the companies I've been talking about for some time, Martin, Dimerix, which we managed to get around 10 cents, some as low in the 7s, just recently ran to 60 cents last week because the World Health Organization has endorsed a trial up to 7,000 patients for a chronic kidney drug on the effects of COVID. So that certainly endorses Dimerix. I'm also looking at companies with ARDS, respiratory issues, lung issues, and a lot of these companies, I think, are still wildly undervalued. I'm looking at a company called Adalta, which will go into clinical trials, hopefully at the end of next month, for IPF of the lungs, which I think is going to be certainly an important area. And we've seen the stunning performance from Mesoblast on their RestenCell product for COVID. Again, I floated an Exosome company, which is trading around 24-25 cents, Exopharm. But I should disclose to viewers, I am the fourth largest shareholder in that company. So basically, my kidney twins, Proteomics and Dimerics, are doing well. They have taken off. But again, I'm looking further down these small biotech companies that are going to benefit from the fact that the long-term impacts of COVID-19 won't be known for a long time. But again, you're going to be aware of the sharks. A lot of these hand sanitizer wipe companies are starting to be exposed as they involve people from the seedy underworld. So again, be careful, but I'm certainly very, very bullish on the biotech sector. And we're still buying shares. I just think that's one area where people should take a little bit of risk capital, Martin. I know it's not for everyone. I know people often say, well, you know, I shouldn't be investing in the stock market at all. But there's obviously going to be companies that are going to outperform. And every year there's a list of companies that provide outstanding returns. But certainly that biotech sector is something I'm very enthusiastic about, passionate, and I do have access, luckily, to some of the best minds in that sector. And once we're able to get back on the conference circuit, you know, the conference in Queenstown, which is worth going to, but it's a lot of work. But I think this illness, COVID-19, is going to open up a lot of health issues, and I think it's going to extend to organs and general well-being, and even to mental health as well, Martin.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you for that, Tony. I'm just going to go and call out the super chat. So with benefits, thank you very much for your contribution there from Dean as well. And for Javier, thank you. And Nico, reverse French, thank you for that. Nico said, Tony, can you get the Queensland border to open for us Victorians and give me a stock market tip? So just take that on notice. I'll just go down the list and then you can think about your tip. Ron, thank you very much for that and your contribution there. SA said, I was thinking of taking out my super to pay a chunk of my uni debt. Good idea, a waste of money considering the uncertainty ahead. Give you a chance to think about that, and I'll get your thought on that in a second, Tony, as well. Nifi, thank you very much for that. Matt, we've covered. And Chris and Lowe, thank you as well. So, two questions. The first one is paying off university debt. I'm not sure exactly how that works. Doesn't it depend on how much you end up earning as to whether you actually have to pay the debt back or not? I mean, it seems to me quite a complex equation to try and work out whether it's a good thing or not a good thing. What do you think, Tony?
I'd keep the super. I just think if you can hang on to your super, that's going to be the best thing. If you look at average growth rates over 9%, and she's obviously young, I mean you've got to stay in it and worry about that other debt later, because I'm sure there's probably going to be avenues where a lot of debt are going to, people can get more time, or there'll be some form of forgiveness. So I think the best thing you can do is hang on to your super, because once you start to take money out of something like that, you start to become undisciplined, and that's the worst thing you can do with finance and anything. And that just leads to complacency, and then you get on the hook, and then hopefully it's like, you know, starting smoking and then you're doing cocaine. I just think you're best to just stay disciplined. People have got to stay disciplined, because there's right assets, Martin, wrong people. And yep. I think a lot of people just aren't suited for investment or anything for that matter.
Yeah. And I just want to highlight the arithmetic law of compounding, right? If you're young and you start saving, even with low interest rates, well, the higher the rate, the better, that will have a compounding effect. So essentially, you know, your university debt is presumably just going to accumulate a small amount of interest at some point. I'm not sure how it's going to work. But the accumulation, the cumulative effect of investing and compounding actually is a very powerful point to future value. So I've always of the view, start saving early, save regularly, and essentially allow compounding to support what you're trying to do, because I think that's actually a very, very good way of effectively building wealth for the future. That's just my perspective, you know, not financial advice, as we've said. Okay, cool. Now, stock tip. I don't know whether you want to go there, but if you do, now's your chance.
Look, the problem I've got, Martin, is if I give my best stock tip, people are going to rush in and and try and buy it.
Yep.
Why don't I just give a handful of stocks for people to research? Would that be better?
Yeah, great. Good idea. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, well, we've just had the stunning performance from Dimerics, so I'm suggesting to clients the next one that's moving into trials, which has been decimated, is Adalta. Code is 1AD. They actually have an alliance with GE Healthcare, and it's a treatment for fibrosis based on the antibody of a shark, a very interesting company. Extrapharm, I've mentioned to death on this program. The code is EX1, which are in the field of exosomes, which is a potential new class of medicine. My other biotech, which I'm still buying, is Narada. Code is NYR. They are looking at a traumatic brain injury drug, which viewers of Home and Away would have noticed that John Palmer had a stroke on the show. And what the aim of the drug is to do is to slow the damage to the brain for people with a stroke, and the traumatic brain injury and concussion, which pretty much affects every contact sports player. So they've now decided to do studies on the brain. This company, I should disclose, I am about the 12th or 13th largest shareholder. It does have some of the sharpest biotech minds in the States as directors of the company. So that code is MYR. They're around 17 cents. Look, a lot of people, I think there's opportunities for companies that can drill in, go in and find a mine where you can make 5 to 10 times your money on a successful discovery. I have $50,000 of my own money invested in a company called Red Metal. The code is RDM. Oz Minerals are paying for their exploration, so they will benefit once the Queensland borders are opened up. They're looking for a Cannington silver deposit, which is now owned by South 32 and produces 6% of the world's silver. So again, I know I harp on about it, but these stocks are cheap till they're not. But I think I'm better off to give a list of companies. Now, for people that are interested in gold stocks, I've raised a small gold company called Hammer Resources, money at 2.2 cents. They are around 3.3, 3.4 cents. The code is HMX. And the geologist who found the Gruyere deposit for Gold Road, which was about 4.7 cents, I think that stock might have peaked around $1.70, $1.80. Ziggy Lubinecki just exercised his own options. So he put $300,000 of his own money in that company at 3 cents in the last week. And based on what I've been looking at, all the growth traits of a small gold company I see in Hammer Resources, because I was involved in Northern Star at 5 cents. Admittedly, it went to $15. I don't think I'll ever see that performance again in my lifetime. But HMX, I think, has those aspirations, has the right management to grow. So what I'm suggesting to my clients is we've had our fun with the producers. It's time to move down the food chain. So there's some stocks for people to research, Martin.
Thank you very much, Tony. That's good and, very very informative, and people are actually acknowledging that. Plexus just commented, there you go. You only start paying off HEX after the 46K taxable income. I knew the taxable income. It's interest-free, but technically rises at the same rate as inflation. So, yeah, I think the advice is spot on. Okay, well, we've been running now for more than an hour. So, Tony, I'm not sure how much more of this you can stand. There's always more questions. So should we do another 5 minutes or so?
Look, I'm happy to keep going. It's been the fastest hour of my life. And the only program I've got coming up is Big Brother, which I admit I'm going to watch it because I need train wrecks TV, and it's just to see the psychology and strategy of these people, which some of them appear complete nutcases, Martin. So yeah. No, let's keep going.
All right, great. Okay, well, I'll just acknowledge Joseph. Thank you very much for that contribution. Really appreciate it. You might notice that I've managed to get my chat thing working in now, so that's good. So let me just go down the questions and see what else. There are so many questions here. I'm never going to get to all of them, unfortunately. Cookie Boy agrees, keep the money in the fund, so that's good. Now, Alex, this is an interesting one. Alex says, a lot of smart people are buying metals. I wonder which smart people you're thinking about, Alex. Okay, Tony, what's your take on gold and silver?
Exhausted at the moment. But what I've suggested to people is if you deal through the Perth Mint, there are some decent silver depository programs where your fees aren't astronomical. And I see the key for long-term wealth for the youth is to dollar-cost average silver and gold. So I just think a bit of a downturn will be welcomed, but not the Harry Dent-style downturn that's been forecast, Martin.
Harry Dent, yeah, well, you know, he always takes an extreme view on gold, as you know, because he thinks that we're going to be in a deflationary future, which is back to our earlier conversation, so I appreciate that. Okay, now, Cookie, a good one from Cookie. Perth retail sector, is it worse? Is it better? What's going on? And I noticed there was another announcement today of, I think, more closures, so, you know, it doesn't look too flash from a distance, but what's it like on the ground?
Pre-COVID, I'd walk from West Perth through the city and the for lease signs is off the chart. This is pre-COVID. I think it's only getting worse. We have a little precinct called King Street where people, you know, the Louis Vuitton, that's all dead. That's dying. Leederville is quite a vibrant area, but again, I think it's just people, it's a bit of a relief rally for people to get out and go to a restaurant because last night, Monday night's normally the quietest night in Leederville, but it was actually packed last night. I think, honestly, retail, these funky shops are dying. Unless you have loyal clientele, these toy shops, record shops, alternate shops, I just think we're heading back to basics. So our retail sector's looking, in Perth, looking pretty grim. And we're having major redevelopments of Karrinup and Innaloo. I think they're looking to spend $600 million. We're going to have new units trying to create some vibrancy in an area that's not vibrant. So I think for now, our retail sector is overcapitalized.
Very interesting. And I suspect, I'm stuck. I didn't push the button far enough. There you go. Yeah, okay, very interesting on that. And look, I'm watching the decay of retail down the East Coast like you wouldn't believe. I survey small businesses, a lot of them are retailers, and a lot of them are saying, I can't do this anymore, right? The rents are too high, there's no trade, and post-COVID. So I'm going to think we're going to see acres and acres of retail space vacant, and that's going to have a negative impact on real estate trusts. And I'm not sure how much more construction there will be in the commercial sector for a few years. So I think this is a big deal, personally.
Yeah, I was in Dublin 2010 because when I had money, I followed Pearl Jam around Europe. And Dublin in 2010, it was pretty bad. And on the front pages of papers in Dublin, they were talking about negative equity and the mental impact of how school teachers and essential service people couldn't move from their houses. So I still think that's all to come, Martin. But again, you know, from 2012 to 2019, Irish house prices actually increased. So yeah, but Dublin was pretty grim. It was pretty much half the city was for lease. And this was in 2010, a few years after the Celtic Tiger burst, the bubble burst.
Yes, and remember that it doesn't all happened immediately. So if you look at the US, home prices slid over 3 years from the global financial crisis. And already seeing some early indicators, I've noticed some prices in Brisbane have been sliding. The western areas around Sydney sliding. So, you know, we are seeing some interesting early indicators. Now, Tony, there was a couple of interesting questions here. I'll pick this one from RM. Uranium stocks, get in now while it's undervalued, due to come back into cycle. And there's a couple of others saying, why you don't talk about uranium at all? Any thoughts there?
I actually have a uranium stock that we're... Look, there's a stock that I trade in uranium sectors called Bannerman. Code is B for Bob, M for Mike, N for November. And it's run by Brandon Munro, who is one of the world... I think he's one of the best in the world at talking about supply shocks, especially in Kazakhstan. And when he got all these major uranium mines coming off, the price was down, you know, in the low 20s. I think uranium is an outstanding play for contrarians, and I think that could be certainly the way of the future. And it's amazing the impact that obviously Chernobyl has had on our mentality. But you've seen 60-minute shows where they're saying we should go nuclear. Look, Bannerman as a trade, there is a stock that I quite like, but viewers should be warned it's very illiquid. It's called Morencia Energy, code is MEY. My clients have some decent holdings in that stock. They're buying up uranium cheaply per pound, and they're having some good results as well. So, look, I don't think the uranium bubble is going to be anything like 2005, 2006, where I think it got to about $149 a pound, and every tech stock became a uranium stock, and it was absolute madness. And again, you had the pain where the likes of Paladin went into production and pretty much went under, but you had a handful of winners. So, yeah, certainly as a contrarian play, pick your favourite uranium stocks. I think there's some decent upside there, Martin. But as I say to viewers, if you're keen on the sector, Brandon Munro's commentary is some of the best you'll ever read. And I've met him a few times, so I vouch for Brandon.
Excellent. Well, that's good to know. Thank you for that. Let me do a couple of things. I'm just going to push this button here for a second so I can come there. I just want to play with my buttons for a second. There you go. So just remind everybody, if you haven't subscribed to the YouTube channel, please do so that you get alerts to our posts. We do post most days, and we want to try and continue to grow our subscriber base. Also, if you are a subscriber and you get value from this, do share these posts with other people too, because we think there are important conversations that aren't being had in the mainstream media that we want to have and continue to have. And of course, if you feel so inclined, you can support us via Super Chat, via Patreon, or by other means. It's all on the channel there. So just want to sort of throw that up there. It's pretty amazing because we've got nearly 40,000 subscribers now. You know, we've been doing this for a year and a half, 2 years. And in fact, I looked the other day. My first live stream was just over 2 years ago. So it feels like forever. Okay, now here's one from Cookie Boy. Whether this is up your alley, but nuclear is old technology. We've got the biggest backyard in the world. Why not make massive solar farms? Well, you know, I've been preaching for some time that the idea of being able to build a sustainable energy future is critical, I think, for our success as a nation, and yet we seem to be barking up the wrong tree completely. I personally think that solar is a very good way to go, and we have vast areas across the country. So Tony, have you got a different perspective?
Yeah, there was a bit of a geothermal bubble in 2005, 2006, and the geothermal sector took a lot of institutional money down the gurgler with it, and that there were addressing the issue, especially in South Australia, for a combination of wind, geothermal and solar, but it's all amounted to bugger all, to be honest. But that could be a decent consideration once we get through what we're going through at the moment. But a lot of those costings, I think that, as you can see in Europe, that uranium and nuclear does the job, Martin. So, look, something to consider, but the cost and the infrastructure at the moment have been too great for anyone to really succeed in Australia. And this was 15 years ago this was addressed, especially with geothermal.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, it's a fascinating area, and you know, the costs of those farms is dropping and dropping and dropping, and of course the challenge is to wire them into our power systems in a way that makes it useful. Because I don't know whether you've seen, but they're talking about turning solar off because they can't swallow the power back in the system. So it seems a bit nuts to me. If only we had a more strategic view of power. Now, I just want to address this one. George asked, why did you lose 200 odd subscribers? I don't think I did, you know. I don't know where you're getting those numbers from, but our numbers have been growing quite steadily over the last little while. So, but there is a difference between the public reported numbers and the numbers actually shown in the channel. So maybe that's the difference. But no, we're not quite at 40,000 yet, but you know, we're getting there slowly. This is just a nice one. Well-deserved subscribers, thank you very much. Deserve more. Yeah, I agree. Nice to have an alternative, a realistic alternative to the MSM monotone drones and narratives. Thank you. Well, we are trying to give a range of views and opinions. And, you know, the fact is that there are lots of different ideas out there and lots of different ways of thinking. But what we're trying to do is to shed a bit of light and hopefully help people with a little bit of an understanding of you know, what's going on. Because the fact is, we live in a very complicated environment, a very complicated world, but the financial decisions that people are taking now will actually be with them for at least the next decade. And unfortunately, my view, and I don't know what your view is, Tony, my view is a lot of people are making very dumb decisions at the moment because they are on the property trick, or, you know, they're going to the stock market at the peak. There has to be a way of trying to actually get more balance in the conversation so people make better decisions. What do you think, Tony?
Oh, that's absolutely impossible, Martin. I came up with a saying that I've mismatched from a few people, and it's fear is temporary, greed is perpetual, human stupidity is infinite. And no amount of financial... I send my clients pep talks all the time. You know, a client's up 600-800% on a stock and he's still complaining. I see every mistake, I hear every excuse there is not to do the right thing. And for me, honestly, it's frightening because we rely on David Koch. We rely on these mainstream programs for financial advice. But the real world... The real world is what's happening now, what you're commenting on. But I don't think even Scott Pate rolling out a financial literacy program in schools, I don't think it's going to have, it should help kids. But we are, humans are programmed to buy assets high and sell assets low. And my job is to slow that process for clients that come to me. And I work hard. It's not easy. It's definitely not easy. I get beaten up a lot of the time, but the rewards are there, and it's hard work. It's taken me 22 years to do what I do, but now we're having experts come out and day trade, buy Afterpay, make a lot of money, and wipe out a lot of shorts at the same time, and then ask questions on Robinhood. If they buy a stock they don't like, can they hand it back? So, yeah, the world's gone crazy.
Yep, certainly has. I can't agree more, Tony, I'm afraid. I'm just looking at down the chat. There's a few conversations there about solar and about the batteries. We looked at putting solar and did the sums and then realized that without batteries, you couldn't actually make really any significant returns because of our power usage. Then we looked at the cost of batteries and the replacement cycle and said, it's not going to work. So it is complex. I mean, the mathematics of it locally, I think, are quite complicated. So I think the large scale stuff probably has a better future potentially, but just bigger investments up front. Okay, let me just one quick look down the other list, just see what else we've got, Tony. I think we're probably running close to view activity. There you go. Oh, okay. Yep. No, I think we've picked all those up. Okay. Well, I think that's pretty much. I mean, there are lots more questions, but I think we've gone around the houses quite long enough. So, Tony, last thoughts from you. Over the next 6 months, prices for property up or down? Stock markets up or down? What do you think?
I think the stock market correction way overbought, just a fund of just the flow of fund money. So the stock market will be lower. Property prices, if they're actually reported, I think are going to start the nasty decline. And I still see the median price in Sydney heading towards $640,000, which based on our terrible incomes or lack thereof is still going to be overvalued on a historical basis. And I've actually been reading tweets from the guy who wrote the book about the Canadian bubble, saying that their religion's property, resources, and it's never going to end. So we're very, very similar to Canada. And before I leave, I did mention that I did do the Pearl Jam European tour in 2010. I actually said when I had money, all my money is in my stock convictions, Martin. It was when I had money to waste on a Pearl Jam European tour, or I could actually fly somewhere.
Excellent.
I'm just going to disclose that. And people come back in the comments and say, well, I don't put my money where my mouth is. But yes, I did that after the V-shaped recovery after the GFC, Martin, which was actually a real V-shaped recovery because a lot of the stock market, stock prices went back to where they came from and resource stock recovery. So I should disclose that. And as I said before, that's not two TVs in the background.
Right, thank you. And then finally, just from me, and one last question to you. I've got a few people who basically say, look, I've never invested in the stock market before. What's an entry point? You know, how should I go about it? And you know, what are there any principles that you can suggest in terms of actually putting your toe in the water for the first time? I think it's a really good question. Are you able to just give a bit of advice before we close?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the start is to find someone you can trust. Find someone that's got your best interests in mind. That if they do the wrong thing by you, there's compliance documents where you can be actually covered. So if you're a grandmother who says, I want to buy bank stock, and they put you're put into a listing stock and it drops 80%, which they did, you've got a course of action. So, I mean, I'm trying to teach people to be financially and mentally fit, Martin. And I think what people need to do is to let go, to have some trust. Say, look, here's $5,000, $10,000. What can I do in the stock market? Because your other option is to swim amongst the sharks. Look, as I said, I'm here to educate people. What we do, these interviews, is my spare time, Martin. But I find markets fascinating. I find the human psychology side even more fascinating. But look, if people are most welcome to send me an email, and I might write a generic email on how to learn the best sources to learn the stock market, the best program. So I think I'm happy to put that together, Martin. Give people a start. As I said, I don't need to go out and chase business because once you start to get results and you start to work with people, I don't need to go out and find it or bullshit people into signing up. So I will put that email together, which will be a benefit to your viewers and no obligation. You can take the information and run. So maybe they could contact, we could put my email address somewhere at some point.
Sure. No, we'll do that in the comments below, Tony. And, you know, if you once you've sort of prepared it, if you like, and you want to come on and talk about it, we can make a show about it as well, because I actually think a lot of people are quite concerned about how to sort of put the toe in the water. So I appreciate that offer. No, that's very good. Okay.
Happy to do that.
Tony, I just want to say thank you so much for spending this evening with us. Very appreciative audience here. We've had more than 800 on at peak concurrent, which is tremendous, so thank you for that. Very interesting points made. You know, underscore again, not financial advice, just opinion, but nevertheless I think some really important points made. In terms of let me just switch over to here. In terms of next week I'll be going through my finance and property scenarios on the 16th of June 2020. The week after that, I have Robbie Barwick teed up. Robbie, of course, is all about bank reform and those sorts of things. So he'll be coming on for a live chat. And the week after that, I've got Damien Klassen from Nucleus Wealth teed up. And Damien is, again, also in the finance sector and leads an investment fund. So it'll be interesting to get his perspective too. So, Tony, I just want to say thank you once again for your time. We really have appreciated it. I certainly learned a lot and enjoyed speaking with you tonight. Thank you to the audience. Thank you to Plexus for moderating so well once again. It's great. Really does make a huge difference. Thanks to Cookie for all his comments and support as well, and for everybody else. And we'll see you next week for a DFA conversation around property and finance. And I'll also have my postcodes available if anybody needs more postcode information. Anyway, thank you very much, one and all. Thank you, Tony. Have a great evening. And we will now play the outro. And I wish everybody a good evening. See you later.